thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
I really do.
Here's John Williams.
Doesn't always work out, but I want you to know I'm making an A-plus effort. Hi, it's John Williams. We're in the Allstate Skyline Studio, downtown Chicago.
Lord have mercy.
We're here until 3 weekdays, and then on Saturdays, listen for a version of this show from 10 a.m. until 12 noon. Remember, The Mincing Rascals is the award-winning podcast. Judged best in Chicago that we record here with Steve Bertrand, with me, with friends from WGN Radio, and also the Chicago Tribune. You want to know what's going on here and across the country and some, I think, pretty good conversation about it? Then listen to The Mincing Rascals. So we've been watching and listening to a little bit the Jason Van Dyke trial, and finally we get a chance to see the video that the defense has created. And I've been watching it over and over and over again. I'm noticing that in the Chicago Tribune, among others, well, they've got a whole host of reporters working on this, Stacy St. Clair and others, but they write, in the animation, McDonald is shown walking down Pulaski Road as Van Dyke and his partner get out of their squad car. Remember now, if you're just joining us or new to Chicago, about 4 years ago, a 17-year-old youth named Laquan McDonald was walking down a street in Chicago. He had been suspected of committing some crimes, and when he wasn't obeying the cops were following him. They asked him to stop. He wouldn't stop. They were waiting for a taser to arrive, and while they were awaiting, the vehicle with Jason Van Dyke arrives. Van Dyke gets out. 6 seconds later, shoots 16 shots over the span of 14 seconds, killing Laquan McDonald. We are 4 years from that moment, almost, and now the trial is finally taking place. There are down to 2 counts of murder from the first degree against Officer Van Dyke, 16 counts of aggravated battery. So we're watching this video now that the defense has created based on the video, but not from the angle that we've all seen, because that's from behind Laquan McDonald looking forward to Jason Van Dyke. We're seeing it from Jason Van Dyke's vantage point. We're also seeing an overhead video that the defense has created. When you watch this, it doesn't look much different than the video. To me, when you watch this video, the shooting still looks egregious. It still looks like he's a full lane of traffic away from the officer, because he is, and you see him simply spin. I thought that they were going to create the video where they took a little artistic license, where they made him sneer or look or do something that wasn't already evident in the video. You know, I know there's sort of boundaries that they would have to adhere to, but I thought maybe they'd have a slightly different spin. Here's one compelling thing, though, that the defense has in its favor. They show a foot counter. This is really smart. 29 feet, 39 feet, 29 feet, 19 feet. He's getting closer and closer and closer. Remember, he's walking down the street and Van Dyke is up ahead. So while we've always focused on the fact that Laquan McDonald was walking down the center line and leaning a little to the right, that is, you'd think that means he's walking away from the officers left to right. He's actually walking toward the officers because they're up ahead. So while his lateral movement, that left to right, is a little bit, in fact, he's going 5, 10, 15, 20 feet closer to them as he closes in on them. So from Van Dyke's vantage point, Laquan McDonald is getting closer and closer and closer. But from behind, you don't really have that view. You simply see the left to right. You see him walking away from the officers left to right. He is. But you don't notice that, in fact, he went 39 feet, 29 feet, 19 feet, 16 feet, 13 feet, and then Van Dyke opens fire. But the animation does not show Laquan doing anything that looks menacing. You don't see him turn and raise his arm. You don't see him swinging the knife. To their credit, the video seems to be relatively true to the video. They did not take much artistic license. On cross-examination, the state is asking questions of the video creator like, well, in the video, we see Laquan's knife. That is, in the animation that you've created, one of those 3D digital things, we see Laquan's...
Hey, John, can I interrupt you for just a second?
I know what you're doing. Go ahead.
We're getting the Bill Cosby sentence, and we are hearing it's 3 to 10 years in prison, so We don't know exactly how long that will be, but obviously no more than 10 years and no less than 3 years in prison. We'll clarify it for you as soon as we get more information.
I'm going to ask you a question you may not know the answer then to. 3 to 10 years per count or 3 to 10 years total?
I do not know that at this point.
Okay, 3 to 10 years, the first announcement on Cosby. So he's now walking away. It could have been a matter of months, and obviously it sounds like it'll be, at least as sentencing goes, no fewer than 36.
Yep.
Jump back in when you need to.
I will.
So the video shows, this animated video, shows Laquan with the knife in his hand. On cross, the state says, well, where's the police officer's vest? The video creator said, I didn't put it in there. She said, wait a minute. Why didn't you put the video in there? He said, well, I didn't think it mattered. She says, well, that little knife in his hand? You took the time to animate his hand to show the knife, but you didn't show that this police officer has a vest underneath his uniform offering him some protection? He said, I don't see how that's relevant. She goes, wow. And you know what she's doing. For one thing, maybe that does offer the officer some protection. But what she's really doing is saying, wait a minute. So you guys, in fact, are showing a version of events that favors your side, but maybe not a true version of the events. For instance, in the defense that the video created that I'm describing, they show 5 of the shots. Well, Laquan was shot 16 times. Every bullet hit him. Maybe that's not too surprising. He was firing from 13 feet away. But they only showed 5. He said, well, we think the first or second bullet killed him, so it really wasn't necessary to show all of the bullets. And, of course, it doesn't do their case much good if time after time they showed the bullets. And the way they animate the bullets, because they're too fast to see, is with a line, the way you would in an NFL or when you're watching golf and they show the shot. They show an animated line that, you know, depicts the trajectory, so you see thshoom, 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 these 5 lasers going through Laquan McDonald, but they didn't show you 16. And if the state was making that video, you know they would have. They took great pains to remind us, to walk us through the shots. So now they're arguing back and forth about what the video does and doesn't show. Discrepancies between what you can see on the video and what the animator had to create. On cross-examination, the state took some time to say, wait a minute, when he's spinning around, you show his feet sliding. Did his feet slide? Well, he says it's hard to actually see in the video and to depict that in the animation, to make it a perfect match. She said, well, which is it? Were his feet sliding or not? Now, I don't know what this has to do with anything, right? Except that she's planting the seed of doubt that what they've done is create a favorable version of the video for themselves, but maybe not the truest description of what happened, even if it's not that consequential. It's what his feet did down there. But that's what they're working on. The takeaway for me is that while the video does show Laquan closing in, getting closer, he's also moving laterally away, and it does not look that threatening to me. If I was on the jury, I would come away with, I'm not sure that video helped that much. Especially since, one last point about this, as they're having the conversation, as they make the case, they cross-examine, they make the case, then they say, well, can you show it? So they've been showing that video 50 times. I'm not sure that this video or it even, and then they will refer to the actual video of Laquan's shooting too. So the dash cam video you've seen, the Burger King video you've seen, or the Dunkin' Donuts the video you've seen, and this animation is constantly shown to the jurors. What's that? What impact will that have on the jurors? Is it going to make them, you know, a little numb to it, so that the shock or the awfulness or the totality of it won't actually be that impactful when they go into the jury room and make a decision? Or are they just going to have ingrained in their brain, that guy got shot a lot. I've been watching that kid get shot for a week or two over and over and over again. How can that not weigh against Jason Van Dyke? I don't know the answer to that question. It's one of those two, though, isn't it? So that's where we are in the trial today. We'll continue to follow it with you and for you here on WGN, but we finally get to see the video. If you're Googling around, you'll find it as well. It's very interesting. And we've got live coverage of that trial at WGNradio.com on the stream. Okay, it's 1:16. I want to talk about destination weddings before the show is over. And I also want to talk a little bit about the Supreme Court justice hearing that'll take place on Thursday. Am I the only one that thinks that it would help Christine Blasey Ford? I mean, just as a matter of, I don't know, journalism isn't the right word. But could we get a picture of her without those glasses? There was Kavanaugh on Fox TV last night with his wife. They still look like nice, reasonable people. He said he didn't even have sex in high school. He's, you know, able to flesh himself out as this full, imperfect, but, you know, a plausible person to be a Supreme Court justice. He's fighting back, and that looks good. And all we see of her is this picture of her with that green top and the dark glasses and the smile over and over and over again. I'm just wondering why we don't see a different picture of her. If I were her people, I would find a way to get to the media a different picture of her. And then it also got me to think this. What is in your yearbook? Have you looked at your yearbook in high school or your kids' yearbooks? I remember when Grant Griffin graduated, and I'm just, Brenda and I are kind of reading through the yearbook. Oh, here's the yearbook. Oh, everybody signed it. And you're reading some of the things that the kids put down. And you say to yourself or to the person you married, oh, what's that mean? What's that reference to? I don't know that I like the sound of that. But the kids have these little inside jokes, the same way you and I did in 1977 or 1983. I think none of us want to be judged by the things that are in our yearbooks. And a lot of them are flowery and positive things. You know, they're, hey, Steve, stay true. You're the best friend I've ever had. You're a great person. You're going to have a great life.
RMA always, John.
There's a lot of that. But then there's also, don't forget what happened at Stacy Smith's house. Know what I mean? You know, downstairs, wink, wink. Or best kegger ever. Or, you know, stuff like that. And the parents go, I don't know what kegger was that. I don't know if those things should keep you from bringing a Supreme Court justice or not. But I was thinking, oh, man, I'll bet if we went back to my senior year yearbook, I don't think I want to read that thing now. I literally was thinking, I wonder where our yearbooks are. And if I went back and read it, what sort of veiled or specific references would be there? And would I be happy with what I saw? We'll continue to follow that story today, too. Hey, what did you think of President Trump's address to the UN? We carried this live on WGN Radio today, about half of his speech. You know, he went on for a while. So he was early on in the speech after he welcomed all of the dignitaries. He began to do what I guess all speakers do. He started to list the accomplishments of the United States.
In less than 2 years, my administration has accomplished more than almost any administration in the history of our country. America's so true. Didn't expect that reaction, but that's okay.
So you had two things there, didn't you? Maybe three. But you had him bragging again that his administration is the best ever, and he was certainly better than you know who. And then they all started, there was this pause, and then there was kind of a little bit of a laughter. And then he says, I didn't expect that. And then they laughed a little more. And then the last bit you hear is the applause. I sound like we're in a courtroom and we're analyzing some video. Was that last part of the reaction them supporting him, or was this the world laughing at the United States?
In less than 2 years, my administration has accomplished more than almost any administration in the history of our country. America's so true. Didn't expect that reaction, but that's okay.
I don't know what to make of that.
I think they're applauding his reaction, which actually, he almost made fun of himself.
Right, so that was maybe a self-deprecating moment.
Which you don't see a lot from the president.
But why is it even necessary? That is, he's saying, okay, I didn't see that one coming, but that the main takeaway, that's his recovery. But the point is that they are laughing at the president's bragging about how good the United States is. We're kind of used to it. I think that if you go to a Trump rally, there's some things that when you see him loading up, you watch the animated faces of people behind him. They get very excited about. They can't wait for the part where we get to chant, "Lock her up." They love that line. It's like if you had a singer at a concert and you couldn't wait for them to sing his favorite songs. And I think people kind of anticipate where he's going to say, "We're the greatest ever. We've had the greatest administration, so much better than you know who." And so here it came. And they're looking at each other like, "Wow, they're singing that song. I'll be able to tell my grandkids someday. I saw Trump do that thing he does." That's maybe what that was. Or maybe it was just purely derisive. They're just like, "Oh, please, you've got to be kidding me." You know, the way you laugh sometimes, that was them laughing at the United States. That was them laughing at our president. Now, he may recover that moment, and then maybe they laugh with him rather than at him. But it was just so weird the way it came through the radio speaker today as I was driving down the road. And, I don't know, Steve or somebody said, well, it may be that somebody said something like, "Not so."
There was reporting that someone in the audience said "not true" or something like that.
I couldn't find that.
Okay. Well, yeah,
I looked on Fox News, I looked on Drudge, and boy, if anybody would have reported that, I thought Fox would have. I haven't found it on Fox News. I mean, right, Steve? So maybe what you heard is true. Maybe Fox hasn't. I don't know.
No, you know what? And I heard it from someone else who read it in a tweet from someone who was there.
Well, so, okay, I mean, but the reporting I was reading from CNN said, to be clear, we were watching it on TV. We weren't in the hall. Tom, you wanted to say something on 3. You're on WGN. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hello. Good afternoon. Violetta is correct. I saw the tweet, and now I saw a clip of it on Twitter, and now I'm listening to you. In my opinion, it was a very rare moment of spontaneous self-deprecation by President Trump, and I thought the audience responded to that in kind.
Yeah, positively, in other words. So they were laughing with him in the second part of it. But is my point true, too, that they were laughing at him in the first part of that?
Oh, absolutely. Both things are true. I thought the first part was a chuckle.
Yeah.
And he was surprised. I mean, I think he's usually talking to the camera with his base in mind.
Yeah.
And certainly by any stretch, the UN is no form of his base. But I give him credit, because I'm a never-Trumper. I do give him credit for bouncing back from that, and he won them back sincerely, I thought.
The rest of the speech was much more, you know, it was subdued, it was measured, it was the United States will always go its own way and do what's best for us. We are not interested in multilateral anything. So it was a speech like you would expect. He held his ground, and boy, does he stick up for us on issues of trade. He said, "We are not going to be had anymore." And that plays well to his base. You know, to be honest with you, I think, even though I've read that his philosophy on economics doesn't really hold up, it sure sounds good. Thanks for the phone call. Steve, just a couple of quick text messages based on what we've been talking about so far. First, on the Jason Van Dyke trial. Hey, John, a suspect that is 15 feet away can close in on you in seconds flat. John, but for the fact that Laquan did not stop and follow the police commands, he would be alive, says another texter. From 262, John, as someone who used to sell body armor for both stab protection and ballistic protection, ballistic body armor offers no protection against sharp objects and knives. On cross-examination, the state was critical of the video, the animation that the defense created. They said, "Look, you took the time and energy to show us Laquan's knife. Why didn't you show us the vest that the officer was wearing?" And while this texture may be true, the guy said, simply put, it mattered who they were and where they were, not did he have a vest on or not. But they tried to plant the seed of doubt that maybe the video was not complete or comprehensive or true when they were calling out any discrepancies that they could find. John, please mention that when he started to, this was written to the station, hey, please mention to John Williams, when he started talking about looking at things written in our yearbooks, he made me decide I better check mine and have a huge bottle of whiteout with me. Literally, they're going back and looking at the yearbooks of some of the people in this Kavanaugh hearing and sort of trying to discern who these people were, what kind of environment it was. And boy, just so much extrapolation is taking place. And then because of that, we'll know maybe a little more certainly what did or did not happen in a bedroom at a party. Crazy. Dr. Ford should have a news conference prior to the Thursday event, which will be stacked against her, and it should be on her terms. And Avenatti needs to come forward as soon as possible with his information. That Avenatti guy scares me. He loves the limelight too much, and I think if his circus comes to town, it's not going to help anybody. 708, it says, why don't you talk about what he said, the president, about socialism and communism when he was addressing the UN? You want to talk about people laughing at us? Go figure. Well, the people were laughing at the president, and the president said that socialism and communism are bad. He really spent time talking about the ills of socialism and how it's failed everywhere. And finally, John, once Donald Trump figures out that the UN members were laughing at him, he's not going to be happy. There's something called the MAMA in town right now. I think that's what it's called. Is that what it stands for?
Yeah.
M-A-M-A, what is that?
Medical Alert Monitoring Association.
In our studio right now is Sambit Mishra. Is that Mishra?
Yes, that's correct.
Sambit Mishra. You're the guy, so the Medical Alert Monitoring Association is having a conference in town.
Yes, it's an industry conference for Medical Alert.
And so just talk a little bit about what is that?
Sure. So it's really about best practices in the industry from a lot of the players who've been in the industry for many years. This is an industry that's 40 years old. And so technology has evolved. Market needs have evolved. You have a massive aging population. So I think it's a lot of best practices around how we serve that population.
And the idea is that if I had a medical alert, if my mom or dad had a medical alert and something happened to them, they hit a button and then somebody's notified.
Yes, that's one way that someone can get access to help. There's a number of ways now with new technology. People are talking about voice-activated services, other services that, you know, where we as consumers are becoming more familiar with. I think that we want to bring this also to this population that has a lot of complex
needs. I see. So I could push a button, or I could, like Siri, make it voice activated, say, Siri, I need help, or something like that.
Absolutely. So I think that one of the things that we talk about is that balance and trade-off between, you know, that utility and also the usability for people who are most in need.
It's got to be as simple as possible.
Absolutely.
Both for a senior and a person in some kind of crisis here.
Absolutely. For the caregiver, because you really have two stakeholders most of the time. It's the caregiver, who could be the adult child, and then their parent, often their parent.
Is there some resistance? I'm 58. My parents are in their late 80s and 90. They're independent. I don't know that they would want something like this. Maybe I haven't asked them. But I'm wondering, to what degree are people resistant to the technology?
Absolutely. I think that the key thing is that it's not just about age. In fact, age is just one factor that contributes to people's necessity for this type of service. What we find more often is it's the condition of the user, the member. So if they have had a fall recently, they're much more amenable. If they are recently widowed, this obviously contributes to whether they'd feel
safer.
What
if I'm younger and able-bodied, but for some reason I've been injured? So now I live alone, but I'm in a wheelchair now.
Yeah.
It would be good to have it even if I'm 25 years old, just in case I got in a jam.
Yeah, we actually have users as young as 18, so it depends on disability oftentimes and also just kind of the needs that they have.
Because I do commercials for you guys. Your company is QMedic.
Yes, our company is QMedic.
QMedicHealth.com. And I'll be transparent about this. You know my story. I tell it in the commercials. A friend of mine came to visit his dad. He's like 90. His dad was laying on the floor in the kitchen. He said he just walked in to check on his dad, and his dad's lying there. He'd been there for, I don't know, a couple, three, 4 hours. He said, what are you doing? He said, well, it's that classic, I fell and I can't get up. He fell and he couldn't get up, and he was okay. But it was kind of, I'm going to guess, embarrassing and painful, and right then and there they go, well, if you'd had a button you could have pushed or a voice you could have activated, I would have come and got you. What if I didn't show up? You know, how would you have rectified this situation? So then my friend says, okay, so now you can imagine what it is. He goes online and probably searches medical alert companies, and he's clicking around, doing his homework. He found your company and he went with you guys.
Yeah.
And that's why I called you guys. I said, we should tell this story on the radio because not only is my friend pretty thorough, I trust him. The price was sure attractive to him.
Yeah.
And the technology, he said, worked.
Well, that's, I mean, and that's great. We always appreciate the testimonials from people who are actually using the service or people who know people who are using the service. And I think that's really what we're all about, is this kind of combination of simplicity, providing additional connectivity and proactivity, and then just kind of the affordability of these services.
So how does your device work? Because he I think, has a watch on, or a, you know, a wristband?
Yeah, so you can have a wristband or a neck pendant. Both are waterproof, can be worn in the shower and
bath.
So
you're using press, you're not using voice activation?
No, we're not currently using voice activation. We're looking at that technology, and I think that what we found is that there are usability issues around voice technology, even for younger consumers, about having to have an activation word like Alexa. When someone's in distress, their first thought may not be to say, hey, Alexa, do something for me. So I think that there is going to be that transition. But
or you say help and it starts to play the Beatles. You go, no, in this case. Okay, so then when I push a button with your device, what happens?
Absolutely. So when you push the button, it connects with a call center, a 24/7 call center, which is set up to dispatch emergency services. So
then
local.
I have a speaker somewhere in the house?
Yeah, so the speaker is over a base station. There's a microphone and a speaker. It's very sensitive.
So when I push that, a voice comes on and says, what's up?
Yeah, they'll say, do you need help? And then if you need help, they'll dispatch local emergency services in your area.
If you're able to, you would then say, you know, I'm bleeding, quick, at the ambulance here, or no, this is stupid, I slipped and I'm in a weird position, could you just send my neighbor over, or something like that?
Absolutely. So you can do, you know, call friends and family before dispatching emergency
services. They've got the phone numbers in advance when you set it up.
Yes.
What if I'm in the garage or the yard?
Yeah, so it does work. Our service has 1,000 feet of range, so it works in and outside of the home, in the front and backyard.
Are there microphones then?
No. So obviously you wouldn't be able to communicate directly if you're outside the home, but if you don't answer, they will dispatch if they try, you know, your phone and they
don't
reach
you. But if you're in the home, you go, hey, I've fallen or I'm hurt.
And yes.
Then you'll have a spontaneous live conversation with the person.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and there are different configurations for services outside the home as well. So if you wanted to, there are GPS type devices as well that work for outdoors.
Well, didn't you say that, so if I got that from my grandparents, say, or some my parents, whatever, they're wearing this, that tracks their movement too?
Yes, so we actually track movement and sleep only at the discretion of the user. So if the user doesn't want that, obviously they wouldn't have to have that. But the reason for that is that actually can inform safety. So if somebody's not moving or they haven't woken up, those can be triggers for activating, you know, a call to a family member, maybe not emergency services.
So if I'm the adult child, I go online, click, 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 hit my password. Now I'm connected to mom or dad with their permission, and I can see it's 11 a.m. They haven't got out of bed yet. I would know that?
Yeah, so there's a dashboard that family members can access and look at this information. And it, again, that's at the discretion of the user and
then
the family.
I call them up and go, hey, mom, why aren't you out of bed yet? She goes, oh, I just slept late. Or then it gives me information.
Absolutely. So we kind of leave that to the discretion of the family because there is that tension between the user and the family member.
Is this kind of connectivity a big deal in your industry right now?
Absolutely. I think that this is where we see the future of the smart home is to
provide. It seems
that
a little invasive.
Yeah, you know, I think that that's where we always leave this to the discretion of the user, and it's really only to inform safety decisions, not to kind of, you know, track everything that you do.
Technology is amazing, isn't it? I mean, just think, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, 30 years ago, we didn't have this.
Yeah, and that's actually when the industry began. So a lot of the competitors that we talk to and the partners in our industry, they've been in the business for 40-some years. And that was when there wasn't software to really inform these decisions. Now, you can really use software to inform a lot of more intelligent decisions around people's care.
So where are you guys?
So we're based in Boston. We have a nationwide footprint. And so, you know, we're right now trying to expand. But I think really as we expand, the thing we really care about is making sure we service every individual user to the best that we can. So we really do care that you get the care you need when you need it.
What's the dashboard service that you get in some General Motors cars, right? And if there's an accident, a voice comes on in a real time.
Yeah, the OnStar.
OnStar. My sister-in-law was in a crash and was knocked briefly unconscious, as I recall. The story goes something like this. But as she's coming to, or what wakes her is the voice coming out of her car going, you know, Becky, are you okay? And she goes, oh, well, what happened? You know, and I just thought, oh my God, this is so fantastic that the call centers, I think, in Detroit, She was in Colorado or Kansas or somewhere, but she's having a spontaneous real-time conversation. And she said, yeah, I need some help. You know, and then here come the ambulances. Maybe her cell phone was handy. Maybe she didn't have her cell phone. But, you know, that dashboard, sir, it reminds me of the technology that you guys have.
Absolutely. And I think the more ubiquitous you can make it, whether it's the car or the home, I think that for a certain demographic, this is very important. It's an issue of life and death. So, yeah.
So your company's called QMedic. The bunch of folks here in town meeting about this.
Yep.
Talking about this. Are you giving a presentation or anything?
So I'm actually more consuming information here. I was also just coming out to Chicago and enjoying the scenery. It's a beautiful time here. So
nice town, isn't
it? Yeah, you guys have a nice view here.
Yeah, so, isn't this great?
Yeah. So.
Okay, so your company is QMedic. We do the commercial. Oh, one last thing. So I say in the commercial, it's $25 or $30 a month. Is that right?
Yeah, so it's...
I hope so, because I've been saying it in the commercial.
It's $30 a month. If you buy annual, it's $300. And so, you know, those are the kind of straightforward pricing, no contracts.
But you can go $25 too?
Yeah, well, so the annual, if you convert that to monthly, it's $25 a month, but
you just
pay it up front.
But you could do a month by month too, right?
Yeah, and that's $30 a month.
So for a little more. So if you want to try it out, you're not sure, maybe you do that, and then you want to sign an annual contract, you can do that too.
Yeah, and so everything comes back with a 30-day money-back guarantee. So.
Yeah. Well, good for you guys. I'm happy that this industry exists. You know, as like I said a minute ago, a person who's 58, a lot of my friends are 58, a lot of their parents could, you know, use a service like this, yours or somebody else's. But I think we live in fortunate time that this kind of technology exists, you know.
Well, yeah, no, it's an exciting time in the industry. And we really think that there's a lot more that we can do for seniors. So.
Well, if my buddy is an advocate, and he is. He's one of these no-nonsense guys. There's no frills. So when he makes a decision, he's one of those people that is a decider for some of us. If Mick says this, then I think, okay, I'm going to do that. And after he did his homework, he said, have you heard about QMedic? Their website is QMedicHealth.com. They're in town this week. Nice to meet you in person. Thanks for coming by the studio.
Thanks for having me, John.
Good luck to you guys. By the way, after the news, I want to talk about destination weddings. Steve, is anybody getting married in your family anytime soon? Are there any destination weddings in your future?
Well, I just went to a wedding in Milwaukee over the weekend. I'm going to one in Iowa in a few weeks.
I don't know if Iowa is a destination wedding.
Well, it is as long as I get there. It's my destination, and when I put it in the GPS.
Destination wedding is Acapulco.
Oh. I did I had a group go, had a destination wedding in Ireland this summer.
Seriously?
One of my trips, yeah.
So it was a couple?
A couple, and then about 45 of their friends and relatives.
Really?
Yeah.
Really? And they all went to Ireland?
Yeah, and we set it up for them.
Okay, that's nice. I got to tell you, Steve, I don't know that I'm on board. I overheard a conversation on the L stop the other day about a destination wedding. I want to tell you about that and ask you about destination weddings after you do the news at 2 o'clock. But if you do want to plan a destination wedding, I recommend Steve Bertrand Travel. So I'm not knocking it for your sake, Steve.
No, it didn't sound like it at all, John.
My best friend is having a destination wedding.
Where are you going, V?
Serbia.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
I don't even know what to say to that. I don't even know what to say to that. Like, if you want to go to Serbia, how many people are they expecting to go to Serbia?
A lot.
That's amazing. Okay, we're going to have that conversation after 2 o'clock.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
All right, we got one.
Here's John Williams.
I think we have the news click. I think we got the new news click ready. Hey, it's John Williams. Every day we post a different web mail question.
Lord have mercy.
The news click is our daily... question about something going on in the news. We ask you what you think about it. You get to vote with your mouse at WGNradio.com. We got a new one today. In fact, Elif, when you have it up, let me know, and then we'll go ahead and ask you to announce it, and we'll launch the new one. The one we asked you recently, I think this was yesterday, was Rod Rosenstein. What would you do if you were him? Quit, said 8%. 87% of you said wait to be fired. And 6% of you had this option, said you would change your identity and flee the country. But most of you said you would wait to be fired rather than quit. Remember, we talked about that yesterday with a constitutional law professor and also with a reporter from Washington Post. They both reminded us that it's very important not just to save face, do you quit or do you wait to get fired, but it limits the president's options. If the assistant attorney general, if Rosenstein quits, then the president can appoint whoever he wants, essentially. But if the president fires him, then it has to go through a Senate confirmation. And so does Trump want his guy in there to manage the Mueller investigation? Yes. The best way to ensure that is to make sure that Rosenstein quits. But Rosenstein hasn't quit or been fired yet. But what happens is critical. We were just thinking about, well, how would you feel personally about it? 87% of you said on our news click you would wait to be fired. Lots of text message. You can always call or text the show, 312-981-7200. We talked about the Jason Van Dyke trial and the video that you've been hearing about. One of you said from 847, should criminal suspects just be allowed to walk away from the police, John? From 847, John, how can anyone defend a trained in combat police officer that should be able to disarm someone with a knife against a scrawny 17-year-old kid? But a lot of you feel like 630, John, we should all be taught to do as the police instruct us from the moment they approach us. About the president's speech at the UN, 312 says they started clapping when he began to smile and laugh. And this one said, I feel like I'm the only one not on Michael Avenatti's bandwagon. He's always on The View. I said earlier that if Avenatti has, you know, person number three to launch some allegation of Brett Kavanaugh, I don't know. I don't entirely trust that guy. Seems like he's always looking for the limelight, if you ask me. But you may feel different. We were talking about destination weddings a little while ago. So lo and behold, Elif is going to one, Violetta is going to one, and Steve went to one. Steve's was in sunny Iowa. Violetta's is going to be in beautiful Serbia. Okay, just like, this is old school, but this is where all of these conversations have to start. If you marry somebody from nearby, say you're from Milwaukee and she's from Chicago, then you should get married in Milwaukee or Chicago. If the two of you really love Hawaii or Acapulco or France, you shouldn't get married there. You should go there for your honeymoon. Why? Because because everybody doesn't want to go to France or Hawaii. And even if they did, do you realize how much you've just asked them to spend to go stand there and watch you say, I do? I can't get over the expense thing and the time commitment. Now, maybe what that does is it limits the number of people that go. Like you only invite your best friends and family. And by the way, I'm not sure they all love the idea. I mean, sure, we now have a justification for spending money on a swell vacation to France or Iowa. But maybe this isn't most convenient for them. Maybe they...
And it still has to center around those two people getting married. So you're like, well, I wanted to go to France, but I didn't want it to be about you guys.
I didn't want to spend it at the Holiday Inn Mart there.
I know, and then do your stuff. I could have been in the Eiffel Tower having lunch when I was standing there drinking some champagne at the country church, which isn't, you know, that doesn't sound so bad. But I don't you, okay, so here's what I was standing on the L the other day on the platform, and this one woman is talking to somebody, and she's, you know, the way people talk on cell phones these days, very loud, so we were all kind of privy to her conversation. And she was upset that they were getting married in Palm Springs. She said, Palm Springs, that's a honeymoon. Now 200 of us have to go to Palm Springs for their wedding. She wasn't thrilled about it, and she thought it was a ridiculous imposition. What do you guys think about that?
I agree.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, like you said, you'd keep the group small. And, I mean, if you don't want to go, don't go. I don't think the bride would be that offended.
Can I give my website?
If you want to plan one, Steve Bertrand Travel.
I think I agree with you for most every reason.
Yeah. Well, you're not subsidizing these either, right? Like, the bride and groom aren't saying, and they may get a discount at the hotel in Palm Springs, but you can get that anywhere.
You know, I don't want to talk too much about my own situation or what people I dealt with, but and I know of one, or this one, I should say, they helped. They did pick up a couple nights for people.
Oh, yeah. Well, so I'm reading this article about it, Steve, and they said, by the way, they actually mentioned Des Moines. They said, if you do a destination wedding in Iowa, it might be cheaper than doing one in Chicago. I mean, for the bride and groom, and a lot of the people are going to stay in a hotel in Chicago, which is going to cost them a few $100. They're going to take a day and go to Des Moines.
Yeah, but mine's in West Des Moines, and that's a little more upscale.
But it's also further.
But that's a fair question, though. What would you rather do? You got to spend, you know, a day going to and from Iowa. I mean, you know, there's a time factor. But the hotel's going to cost you $89. Or come into beautiful Chicago, and you're going to spend, you know, $287. Maybe some people would say, oh, what the hell, we'll go to Iowa.
Well, you know what, though? There's an option for the bride and groom, which is what the person that I know who's getting married abroad, actually, is doing. And it's to just, in the save the date, they wrote, we won't be offended, we'll completely understand if you can't make it.
Yeah. Do they do that? I thought you were going to say, but then they're going to do a reception back in the States, in, say, Chicago.
No, no.
So they're getting married in?
Cancun.
Cancun. Because who was that I knew? They did that. They had a destination wedding, but then they still planned a little gathering in town for everybody that wasn't going to go travel abroad, right?
Well, I have families in two countries, so that's not an option.
Yeah, my friend's doing that. She's having a little reception here after they get married for whoever didn't make it
in
to
Serbia.
Yeah.
So how many people are going to go to Serbia, do you think?
Well, so this is kind of new. We just picked the date, but it's
we gonna, just picked the date?
Well, I feel kind of a part of it.
You're one of the bridesmaids?
Yeah. So she's getting married sometime in August next year. So, yeah. But you have to do the save the dates, you know, pretty much coming up so people know.
Book your airfare.
And most people that are going, most Serbians are going anyway, you know, around that time. So they can plan their trip around her wedding.
What? Oh, so you think that there's a group of people that would be going to Serbia anyway?
Yeah, friends and family. I mean,
they go back to the old country a lot?
Yeah, either every year or every other year.
Okay, well, that's, I get that. But what's a round trip flight to, what's the city you fly into in Serbia?
Belgrade.
What's the round trip from O'Hare to Belgrade?
Cheapest, $700.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's,
it's reasonable.
Not the end of the earth, but so you're probably out of grand on travel and a couple nights in a hotel.
I just, well, it's also in a, like a kind of a small town, so I don't know where all these people are going to stay. Now that you mention it, I don't know. But their per plate is like ridiculously cheap. They already booked the hall. They put their deposit down. Their deposit's only €350.
Oh.
I was like, what?
Yeah, for how many people?
Like the hall holds 600.
Okay.
They might have dirt roads, but they do know how to party.
Well, that's the thing. They said sometimes a destination wedding can be cheaper because that ain't getting it done in Chicago, Jack. €500, nothing. That is not a deposit on a 600 person or 200 person wedding in this town.
So I told her, so we're getting a Vera Wang dress then.
Well, so yeah, have you thought about that? Like, what's your personal budget? You don't have to answer this question, Violetta. This is none of our business, but this is where my head goes. Okay, I've asked my best friends then to be in the party. They're going to have to get dresses and shoes. I guess that happens if it's in Chicago anyway. And travel, it's a lot of money.
Yeah, definitely. Serbian weddings are a whole nother story, too. It's like my Big Fat Greek wedding. They're 3 days long. First, you're supposed to go party in the female's village. The guy comes pick her up. He's got to shoot a chicken off of the roof to get into the house. Then they go to his place, go to the church, do that for a day.
And
then
the final shoot a chicken on the roof, right?
They don't use a real chicken anymore. Now it's just like a fake chicken.
But a real shooter.
Use a shotgun. And nowadays...
in that case, it's fine.
I'd go with the fake gun and the real chicken if I had to pick.
If I had my druthers, I'd put a real chicken up there and shoot a dart gun at him.
So is there anything about being Serbian that's easy?
No. Well, you have to prove that you can provide for the female.
So being able to acquire a chicken is one
off
way to
of
do
a
it.
Roof,
yeah.
Right.
Okay. Hold on a second, V. Karen, you're on WGN. Karen, what did you want to say? You're on the air.
Our neighbor, their daughter and future son-in-law both grew up in the Hinsdale Burr Ridge area, and they both went to Mizzou for college. But they decided they'd get married in San Antonio, Texas, because they were going to look for a job there. So they expected all family and friends to travel to San Antonio, Texas for the wedding. I think the hardest part is for the grandparents to get back and forth to these kind of weddings.
They don't, and maybe they're going to write this off then as a business expense, but they don't even have a job there yet. But that's kind of their dream place to be, huh?
Yeah. And the worst part, it was in July, and it was horribly hot, and nothing was air conditioned. So
otherwise,
but
it was great.
We got to see the Alamo, so there you go.
Yeah, wow. Thanks for the phone call. Karen, 312-981-7200. Call or text. We're busy at WGN. Hey, Carol, you're on WGN Radio. I'm John Williams. We're talking about destination weddings. Go.
Okay, well, my daughter and her, future husband, both live in Washington State. So when they got married, what my husband and I did, because we had about 6 relatives that were going to go, we covered their hotel bill.
Oh, that's nice.
So that they, just didn't have to pay for their hotel.
They still had to get there, but at least you manage the expense for them, huh?
We covered it for, the Friday and Saturday. So, and then if they wanted to stay after that to do some sightseeing, that was up to them.
Yeah, that's a nice way to go. Carol, thanks for the phone call. That's an option. Somebody's got to pay. Donna, you're on WGN. You're on the air. Hi.
Hi, John. Thanks for taking my call. First off, I love you and your team.
Thank you. Me too.
So it's a pleasure to talk to you. My son and daughter both had destination weddings, similar to Carol for our daughter's wedding, which was in Italy. We ended up paying for everyone's hotel, and that varied from 2 nights to 3 nights. We were blessed because our children both had money saved, and so they did pay for a large portion of their wedding. I will tell you, for our daughter's wedding in Italy, I don't think we would have been able to have a similar venue here in the U.S. for this cost. It was much cheaper for us to have the wedding there. It was expensive for people from the U.S. to come. Just because of both food, what you end up getting for the benefit of the venues there, the cost per plate is probably half of what it would cost at most venues, if not actually a third. In addition, you can do other events that also were reasonable. For example, we did provide a wine pairing, a private wine tour at a vineyard in Italy, and it cost us, there were 22 people from the United States that traveled, and the entire event for that 3.5 hours of pairing was $350.
See, that doesn't even get you on a party bus.
Cost effective
around here. Wow.
Yeah, that's right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, these are all good calls. Yeah, worth it to you guys for sure. I guess that's the two expenses, too. It's like, does it cost more or less to put on the wedding? Maybe it actually costs less to put on the wedding in Ireland or wherever.
If it costs less, do you think that the person who's attending doesn't have to give you a check?
Or it's nice a gift, but it's still going to cost that person money to get there, right? So I don't know if you also think maybe we should subsidize the rooms or something. But look at that. Maybe it's not as expensive. In fact, we're reading some of the texts here. John, my daughter's having a destination wedding. They are doing this as only the people who really matter to them will attend. The cost of the destination wedding is less than if she were getting married locally. John, I agree. We have been invited to a destination wedding in Mexico by people we don't even know very well. We declined without guilt. John, I know someone who is going to get married in Ireland. People made the arrangements, booked the flights, reserved the rooms. Anybody want to guess how this text ends?
Oh, no.
Didn't happen.
And they called the wedding off.
It's still a great destination, I suggested.
Steve and Bertrand who should
Travel. They call? Steve
Bertrand No. .com.
John, it's difficult to do these. If the bride and groom don't treat everyone, you can't just pick some of the people. Carolyn, you're on WGN Radio. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. So my husband is from Vermont, and his mom lives in Vermont. And when I went out there for the first time to meet his mom, one of the things we did was we hiked a trail called the Robert Frost Trail. It was a beautiful trail with all these poems on it sprinkled along the way. And when we were walking in it, I said, if we were ever to get married, we're going to get married under this tree on this trail. And that's what we did.
Oh, nice.
So we hiked the trail. We got married under the tree with about 25 people. And then we had a mini reception at his mom's place. And then 3 days later, we came back and had a reception at Yoshi's Cafe
for 100 people of all of our work friends and, you know, local family and everything like that.
How was that?
It worked out well because there we have a lot of family that are locals, and you know, I didn't want to have everyone feel like they needed to spend all this money to fly out to Vermont and book a hotel and yeah. you know go yeah. through all that expense. So it was much easier to split it up and do it both ways like that.
Thanks for the phone call. Interesting. John, this one says here, my husband is an internet minister. I am too, by the way. Most people in America today are an internet minister. His cousin decided to have a destination wedding in Florida and asked my husband to officiate, but they did not pay for his airfare or his accommodations or anything other than the $25 ministerial fee that my husband asked them for so that he could deduct it as a business expense. Well, that's just a whole bucket of issues. Otto Gonzalez is joining us next. He's waiting in the PPG Paints green room. He'll be on with us after the news. He is with Doctors Without Borders. They have an amazing exhibit in town. This is something you should see after the news. Steve, lots of texts and calls, as you know, about our last conversation about destination weddings. I'll just share a couple with you guys, and then we'll move on. 847 said, destination weddings, unless you're paying at least the travel expenses for your guests, it's otherwise totally selfish. The S word got used a lot in this, and some of you see it that way. But others said, John, you're sounding a bit like an old curmudgeon. The real point of a destination wedding is that it's unique. Anyone can do a wedding at a hotel or banquet hall in the suburbs. There's nothing special about those weddings. You can predict everything that's going to happen. Nothing unique, nothing special if you do it that way. And this one says from 815, are you forgetting that it's their wedding? Who cares what the guests want? If they don't want to make the trip, then don't make the trip. But we want to get married in Spain. Ha! And so off they go. So thanks for your thoughts about that. All I know is I was standing on the L platform, and the woman who was there next to me did not want to go to Palm Springs with 200 people for a destination wedding. And everybody on the platform now knows that.
Yeah, I think just about every wedding decision is fraught with peril.
Oh, my gosh. You know? Yeah, I know. Chicken or fish.
Get married during a holiday weekend to make it easier for people. Well, that's an inconvenience for people.
Yeah, really.
All of that.
Just make sure there's an open bar.
Really? That solves a lot of problems.
An open bar and a chicken to shoot.
My sister planned her wedding purposefully in Chicago so everyone could come.
Have a nice time in the city.
And it was a wonderful wedding.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You weren't. Well, yes. You're welcome.
Excuse me.
You were there. Oh, yeah.
There is an exhibit in town, speaking of Chicago, in Daly Plaza from Doctors Without Borders. My friend Scott Stantis, who we do the Mincing Rascals with, the editorial cartoonist from the Chicago Tribune, was there. And I think he knew some of the people involved. And so he just told me to look into it a little bit, and I did. And I think this is something that if between now and Sunday you have an opportunity to come into the city, maybe you're going to a destination wedding on Saturday, I'm recommending that you check out this exhibit. The media coordinator that's with it is in our studio right now, Courtney Ridgway. Hi, Courtney. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Are you the friend of Scott Stantis?
This is Otto.
And Otto is here also, Gonzalez, who is a nursing supervisor. He's been on 4 Doctors Without Borders assignments. Otto, welcome to the show. Nice to meet you.
Thank you very much.
So this is over at Daly Plaza. What do you guys have over there, Courtney?
It's a 10,000 square foot exhibition. Basically, people are invited to walk through and navigate through a series of interactive activities, including a 360-degree video dome. We have a replica boat from the Mediterranean that many people use to try crossing from northern Africa.
Oh, yeah, boy, I've seen, not of late, but I remember maybe last year we were seeing a lot of the videos of these people on these ramshackle boats, and the cruise ships would sometimes come by and pass them up or rescue them. Who wants these people? Where do we take them if we get them? Those kind of things. Huh?
Absolutely.
And that's going on. That was the big migration of people heading towards Europe, even northern Europe, right? Is that still going on?
Yes, it's going on probably more now than before, even.
I don't seem to be here. Is it just me, or is it not being reported as much or talked about as much?
It depends on where you're getting your information. I think in Europe it's a huge topic, but here in the U.S. we're obviously more focused on our own border issues, and unfortunately the Europe stuff is getting worse by the day.
We're talking about what, the Mediterranean?
Mm-hmm. A lot of people coming from northern Africa will get into these boats via smugglers and try and cross the Mediterranean because many of the land passings have been closed.
And then where are they going?
They're trying to go anywhere that will take them. Greece, Italy, you know,
where
France.
Does Doctors Without Borders get involved then? How, in say, Otto, maybe you have something to say about this. Feel free to speak up. But I mean, let's just start here since we're doing talking about this. How would you guys get involved then? Do these people land in a refugee camp? Is that what happens?
Typically, if they even make it across the Mediterranean, most of these people, these boats are not meant to cross the Mediterranean at all. And they're full of people that, you know, way beyond capacity. So we do have a search and rescue boat called the Aquarius. It's currently the only search and rescue boat in the Mediterranean. And that's providing life-saving missions to prevent more of the hundreds of drownings that happen each week.
Yeah. What are some other hotspots? Where have you gone to?
Where I've worked in Congo, Chad, Honduras, and most recently in Tanzania. Tanzania is not per se a hotspot, but that's all about Burundian refugees coming across the border from Burundi into Tanzania.
You're a supervising nurse. You have a job in
Correct.
Oregon. You work as a nurse in Oregon.
Correct.
But then you take time to also work with Doctors Without Borders.
Correct.
So then we have this immersive experience where you can put on the goggles too, right, and sort of feel like you're at one of these places. Is that it?
Well, if I could talk about the experience a bit. So it's a guided tour with experienced field workers like myself. The tour takes about an hour. It takes you through many components.
Is that me or is that you guys? Stand by. Stand by. Keep going. Where are
we? So we have guides that take you through different facets of what it's like for these people on the move, on the run from their homes, what it's like and what work Doctors Without Borders does in these different settings.
Doctors Without Borders is an international organization.
Correct.
What's the budget for that? How do you guys get your money?
So how we get our money is from donations. We don't take money from governments. We don't take money from certain industries. Really, it's just common people who donate money to us. That's where our funding comes from.
Courtney, did you tell me what the budget for Doctors Without Borders is in a year?
It's over $1 billion. I'm not exactly sure of the number.
That sounds like a lot of money
it
to
is,
me.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's bare bones given the reach. You guys are working around the globe, mm-hmm. but I'm also encouraged by that. You raise that much money a year, grants and donations.
90% of that goes to our field operations on the ground.
So then you set up like what, little hospitals, that sort of thing, triage centers?
So it varies. Project to project is different. I can use the example of my most recent project, which in Tanzania, Burundian refugees started coming across the border. We helped set up a refugee camp. We constructed a hospital kind of out in the bush along the Burundian border. We set up all the water and sanitation in this camp. Those are common missions, but missions vary depending on the different locations. In the Mediterranean, we have search and rescue boats that are picking people up from these very boats that you're referring to.
What's it like in these refugee camps?
So what's it like in the refugee camps? It's an extremely difficult life for these people. Let's start with, you know, one, you have fled the only home you've ever known. You travel who knows how long to get to some place that you think is going to be safe. Oftentimes a camp. You know, when we're talking about refugees, let's clarify that two-thirds of the people who are displaced are actually not refugees. Refugee means you have crossed a border, an international border, and arrived somewhere else. That gives you certain legal rights per international law. But most people are actually simply internally displaced, IDPs, internally displaced people. They're just simply moving from one location to another.
They're in their own country.
In their own country, seeking safety.
But the city they're from is being seized or sacked, and so now they're going somewhere else.
Exactly.
And so you set up a camp and they go there.
Correct.
And, you know, when I see the video and pictures of these people, you see adults, families, people, and I think, well, what has happened to their furniture and their bank accounts and their job and, you know, all of the things that we associate with modern adult life? What happens to all of those things?
That's a really good question, and I think that varies greatly. I'm going to say something about, I've seen lots of people arrive in our camps, IDP, refugee camps, that sort of thing. And one thing that I always notice that people bring with them is they bring their key to their home, meaning they lock the door before they had to flee. So,
and they hope that home's going to be back and habitable when they return.
Exactly.
Not knowing really what. And how long I know these answers vary, but how long is somebody in a refugee camp then?
That amount varies greatly.
Give me a range.
So it can be 10 to 25 years.
Yeah.
And it could be 10 months?
Yeah, that's a very short time.
That's optimistic, really. Mm-hmm. So these people said, okay, we live in City X. Now we're going to just walk with our suitcase and get out of Dodge. And they don't have a refuge to go to. They don't have family in New York, or they don't have any place to go. Mm-hmm. So then they just walk away, and then there's these camps. How do they even find these places? I guess there's a network of people who know people and go, hey, we're all going north, huh?
Yes and no. Definitely word of mouth spreads as to where there are safe places. Sometimes you just simply head to a border. Again, my apologies, but I'll use Tanzania as an example. They made it to the Tanzanian-Burundian border, and then there's an organization called the IOM, the International Organization of Migration, puts them on buses and then brings them to the various camps that are along that border.
And these countries have at least cooperated. They said, okay, we have that land area there that we're not doing anything with, we'll let you set up a camp there, Courtney, or how does that work?
That varies as well. So it depends. Some countries don't allow you to have a camp at all. So some places they have settlements. It's basically you can't have a permanent structure. So people will live for 10, 15 years, have children, raise their families in these tent cities.
And I've wondered about that. I mean, because again, when you see these people, you don't see productivity. Are there jobs for these people there, or are they sitting on benches waiting?
I'm going to back up first to something that you said about where they go to, about land and stuff like that. Realize when you're saying land that's not used, people live throughout these countries and stuff like that. Generally, the land that is set aside for these camps is the worst land possible. When I worked in Congo, it was quite literally on a volcanic wasteland. As I would walk through camp, I would be concerned that I'd break my ankle at any given moment because I kind of like walk like a crab, you know, simply walking over all this. And this is where you live. This is where your tent is. Your home is on top of this surface. As to work, organizations like ourselves, like MSF, Doctors Without Borders, we do hire people out of the camp to work in our project. So that's one way to do that. Some people do, so to speak, make commerce, industry. I have seen people who bring sewing machines with them to the camps when they leave. I have seen people bring solar panels to charge somebody a minimal amount to charge their cell phone.
How big is how many people are in these places?
The biggest camp right now is in Bangladesh, and that has around 950,000 people in it.
Huh. Why?
This particular group is an ethnic minority from Myanmar, which is modern-day Burma. They were fleeing genocide. So they luckily were taken in by the Bangladeshi government, and now there's this camp that just has gotten bigger and bigger and bigger over the last year.
So it's a city.
Basically, yes.
But I guess without resources, without a football team, or do they have schools?
I believe they probably do at this point.
There are different humanitarian groups that do provide education in different camps. I can't tell you about Kutupalong, which is what she's referring to.
A million people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's stunning.
Doctors Without Borders built the first hospital there.
Doctors Without Borders has an exhibit in Daly Plaza. That's why the two of you are here today. It's open weekdays through the weekend. So this is this weekend.
You guys leave on Sunday.
So how do I check it out? Do I just swing by? Tell me a little bit about how we do this.
Yeah, we're open 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. on weekdays, and again from 4 to 8 p.m. so people can head by after work. And then on the weekends from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m.
10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Saturday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. on Sunday.
Yep.
Do I pay to go through this?
No, it's free.
I bet you'll take a donation, though, right?
Yeah, we're happy to. It's not a fundraising effort, but of course, if people feel inclined to give, they can.
Maybe they could do it online, too. What's the website for you guys?
We're www.forestfromhome.com.
Say it again.
www.forestfromhome.com.
As in forest?
Forest. Or doctorswithoutborders.org.
Doctorswithoutborders.org.
And if I can interject something, this exhibition, which has been a traveling exhibition, it's really to raise awareness. That's why we're here. That's why we're doing it. Can people give money? They can. But it is not fundraising. It is not looking for people to work. It is simply so people are aware. Right now, 68.5 million people currently live displaced due to conflict. That's the highest number since we started keeping record.
One last question for the two of you. Does this in any way reflect on U.S. policy towards immigration? The president just spoke to the U.N. today about that. Do either of you have anything to say about that? Courtney?
Seeking safety is not a crime. And that's one thing that we really want to get across is currently U.S. policy is wanting to criminalize these people that are trying to seek safety. And You don't leave home lightly. So the average person that's arriving at another border has left everything behind because they had no other choice.
Seeking safety is not a crime. Amen to that. 68 million people are seeking safety in the world. Well, good for you guys. I know this is part occupation, part avocation for you. It's what you do, too. Thank you for doing that.
Thank you.
Yeah. And thanks for coming in, too.
Thank you very much.
Okay, they're in town. Our friend Scott Standis said, you got to talk to Otto. And Courtney's terrific, too. Gonzalez is a nursing supervisor. He's been with them on a number of assignments. And Courtney Ridgway is the Doctors Without Borders media coordinator. We'll pause here. Ro and Anna are around the corner. This is WGN. Producer Olive, I don't even know what it is. What's the new news click, please?
Would you be embarrassed by the contents of your yearbook? Yes or no?
Yes. I'm yes. Violetta, would you be embarrassed if I read the things that were signed into your yearbook? A lot of people texted this when we mentioned this earlier. They go, oh, my God. I was looking at my daughter's yearbook with her, and I said, honey, what does this mean? What's that all about?
I think I probably didn't have that many friends to write in my yearbook, so I might be embarrassed.
I literally am kind of curious. If mine was handy, I would pull it out. It's stored away in a box somewhere. But I'm sure we said some knuckleheaded things back then. And the only reason that's in the news, of course, is because of the Brett Kavanaugh hearing, which, can you believe this? We're worried about who the next Supreme Court justice is going to be. And part of the evidence in the court of popular opinion right now is the things that people have written in yearbooks. You know, the Republicans are going to get a Republican-leaning Supreme Court justice. So if it's not Brett Kavanaugh, I'd like to counsel everybody in America to not lose their minds. If for some reason this blows up on him because it's political or because he doesn't deserve to be on the Supreme Court, we'll get another one. There was a bunch of people the president was considering. They had a list of about 50 people that they were looking at. We'll find another guy and he'll be fine. Maybe it'll be a gal. It won't matter. You'll get your conservative Supreme Court justice. So if it's not this guy, it's not his right. We don't owe him anything except, you know, a fair hearing. And I don't know if that's possible anymore because we're looking at inscriptions in yearbooks. But my advice to everyone is to just, like, chill. Yeah, we got to take a break. Coming up, the stories. So that's the news click. Would you be embarrassed by the things that are maybe in your yearbook right now? Go to WGNradio.com. Rokan and Anna DeVlantis check in 60 seconds. Just one other thing. The president was in a soundbite in the news a little while ago disparaging Christine Blasey Ford's, you know, accusations against Brett Kavanaugh. And he said, what does she know? Does she remember? Doesn't she remember? Was it a party? Where was the party? She was drinking. He was drinking. Everybody's drunk. I don't think that's actually what she has said. He said he wasn't there. And she has said that she had one beer. Her recollection has been steadfast. She was not drunk at that party. She said she had one beer, that the others had been drinking heavily. Rokan, Anna DeVlantis, what are you guys doing today?
Stand by. Yeah, we got a lot.
We do.
It's a great strategic advantage of starting a show in the middle of the afternoon when all of a sudden everything has just happened. The president got laughed at by the UN today.
Yeah.
That happened. I don't think he's happy about that.
Well, you heard what he said.
They're laughing at us. And he always says that. They're laughing at us. Well, they really were laughing today at us because of you. And so we'll explain what happened there.
It was quite the boast he had before that.
Yeah, he thought he was at a campaign rally, and then, you know, with people wearing earphones. So you got to know your audience. When your audience has to have an interpreter, and then what was really funny about it was that there was an interpreter lag to the laughter.
It was delayed laughter.
Because it was like...
It's like, that landed well. Oh.
I'm the greatest ever. And then everybody started, you know, beat, two, three, laugh. Uh-oh.
And then he said, I didn't expect that. And I thought, really? You didn't expect that?
Yeah.
Maybe you'd get a little blow. You've been making fun of or criticizing the UN forever. Right. And now when you say, we're the best, you don't think
He says he's the best. No one's done a better job than he
in
has.
In less than that's true. 2 years, he's accomplished more than any administration.
So that's right. Anyway, there was that.
Ever.
Then there was the sentencing. All this is going to get handled in the first hour here. You had the sentencing of Bill Cosby in Pennsylvania. 3 to 10 years, minimum of 3 years. They took him right away in handcuffs. There's dramatic pictures of him being walked out, perp walked out of the courtroom. And the Van Dyke trial has ended for the day after kind of controversial cross-examination of the video.
Did you guys watch that video?
Yes. Yeah, I saw the video recreation.
Do you think that helped the defense?
No. No, I don't think it did. I think that by the prosecution, and we'll get into some of the detail of this, for those who did not see it, which is basically everybody, there was a video recreation of the incident so that you get sort of a almost like a video game perspective of the shooting from not only the video we've all seen, but also from the perspective of the police based on a recreation on the distances and the timing of the video and all that. And the way that it was constructed, the prosecution was able to pick it apart by saying, "Well, why is he wearing a hoodie? He wasn't wearing a hoodie in the actual incident, was he? And do you make him look bigger than the other people here?" And it was they'd go, "Yeah, well, I guess he does his shoulders out of place.
Why does the street look different?
The officer doesn't have a vest on in the video."
So there's a lot of different pieces in this that didn't quite that I don't think played particularly well because they were able to pick it apart. But
all right,
we'll do all that. Thank you very much, John. And I got Blackhawks tickets for opening night.